It's just after 5:30, so I think maybe we could start on time, especially since you've all been very generous in arriving to listen to the talk at the beginning of this particular conference. And maybe I should begin just by putting this in a little bit of context and even introduce myself. I'm Keith Richards from the Geography Department, and I've been a participant in events that have actually been taking place throughout the year in relation to something which is not specifically referred to on this slide, which is a programme of activities funded by Mellon Sawyer under the general heading of Modelling Futures, Understanding Risk and Uncertainty. And these activities have included a series of, if you like, relatively small-scale events like reading group activities at lunchtimes, and then four two-day workshop seminars on various topics: financial risk, health regulation, environmental risk, and democratizing risk. And they took place approximately quarterly through the year, and they've led up to the conference, which is happening over the next 2 days, for which many of those of you sitting here are registrants. But this is a public lecture which kicks the whole process off. In fact, there are two public lectures, so if you didn't really know this, it's worth me plugging the second one before we start with the first. The second one is at the same time and here in the same place tomorrow evening, and it's to be given by Lord Krebs, Professor Sir John Krebs, former Chief Executive of the Natural Environment Research Council, Chairman of the Food Standard Agency, and currently Principal of Jesus College, Oxford, and he's going to talk on risk, uncertainty, and regulation. Tonight, the speaker is Professor Mike Hume from the University of East Anglia. I guess it's improbable that there are people who don't know, sitting here, who don't know who Mike is, and therefore I don't really need to say very much by way of introduction. He was the founding director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, having been a reader in the Climate Research Unit at UEA prior to that. He is Professor of Climate Change at UEA. He's been in the process, if you like, of climate change research and its policy context for several years now, as an active empirical researcher himself, a modeller himself, and also as a member of the IPCC in its third, as a lead author in the third assessment report. Latterly, of course, he's quite well known for having written a book entitled Why We Disagree About Climate Change, with the interesting subtitle Understanding Controversy, Inaction and Opportunity, which tells us something more about what the book is really about. And as a result of the book, I think he spends a lot of time these days giving lectures like this one to try and sort of amplify and develop the ideas that he wrote about in the book. So Mike is going to speak first for, I think, about 45 minutes or so. And at the end of that, a colleague of mine from the Geography Department, Professor Susan Owens, who's Professor of Environmental Policy, is going to make a short response. Mike may want to say something about that, we'll see. And after that, I'll try to manage a process of question and answer. We have to be out of the room, I think, by 7 o'clock. So I might have to cut people off a little bit at 7, but I hope there will be an opportunity for quite a bit of discussion and argument. Mike.
Yes, it certainly is the case that using a title, Why We Disagree About Climate Change, opens the space for argument and for disagreement. And so I certainly will welcome strong challenges to any of the things that I'm going to say this evening. Climate models have become central to the unfolding story of climate change. They underpin knowledge claims and risk assessments made by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. These are assessments that, of course, very powerfully shape political narratives of climate change around the world. Climate models are essential for the detection and attribution of anthropogenic climate change. So the well-rehearsed statement from the fourth assessment report of IPCC, most of the observed increase in global average temperatures since the mid-20th century is very likely due to the observed increase in anthropogenic greenhouse gas concentrations. The heart of Working Group 1's assessment, if you will. A statement very heavily rooted in climate modelling activity. And they also claim, this is climate models do, to offer access to the far future by simulating climatic consequences of the development pathways that the world has chosen and that we are continuing to choose. So, again, for example, from the AR4 IPCC statement, anthropogenic warming could lead to some impacts that are abrupt and irreversible. That statement is rooted in climate modelling activity. So climate models have acquired significant authority in the contemporary world. By authority, we might mean formally the power to determine, adjudicate, or otherwise settle issues or disputes. It's taken from the Oxford English Dictionary definition of authority. So models, climate models exercise this power and influence over the academy, over policy debates, over the human imagination. And here are just some examples of the sort of authority that climate models exercise. Here from a couple of years ago, the World Modelling Summit on Climate Prediction, climate models will play a perhaps central role in guiding the trillion-dollar decisions that will be made to cope with the consequences. Or here from the campaigning movement 100 Months and New Economics Foundation are leading, with the advancement of global climate models, it is now known that the impacts of climate change will manifest in more extreme local changes in temperature. Other actors also deferring to this authority of climate models, the Church of England, in its Shrinking the Footprint campaign launched last year. Church of England is relying on the weight of evidence from scientific observation and modelling, and the Church of England is maintaining awareness of projections from climate models of the climate system. And then we also have public intellectuals like Clive Hamilton, the Australian, in his recent book Requiem for a Species. The relentless logic of the climate models proves over and over that the poor and the vulnerable will be hit hardest by climate change. And many, many more that we could find in our social worlds. So how can it be that climate models are able to exert authority over trillion-dollar decisions, over religious organizations, and over the human imagination of the future? What sort of authority is it that is being exercised here? How do climate models gain this authority, and how do they retain it? And a subsidiary question to this, which I'll touch on this evening, is in what ways is this authority recognized differently around the world? The Royal Society's motto famously asserts nullius in verba, on the word of no one, or accept nothing on authority. The corollary of that being carefully to observe, test, and experiment. This scepticism of received wisdom was characteristic of late 17th century and early 18th century Enlightenment, which gave birth to the Royal Society and, of course, to other cultural shifts in Europe. Yet it is a scepticism that human beings find difficult always to practice. Deference to the elder, to the priest, to the celebrity, or to the scientist is difficult to eradicate from our social life. Of necessity, we accept many things on authority every day. But in the case of planet models, I want to ask, is this deference warranted? Again, referring to the IPCC in the fourth assessment report from a few years ago, 2007, where it stated, there is considerable confidence that climate models provide credible quantitative estimates of future climate change, particularly at continental and larger scales. Is there considerable confidence? And for whom? And for where? And for what purpose is such confidence claimed? So the question I'm wanting to ask and examine this evening is, should we trust climate models and let them exercise authority over us? Or put differently, are climate models worthy of our deference? Now, I suggest there are two interrelated dimensions to this question which need examination. What are the sources of climate models' epistemic authority? And what are the sources of their social authority? These two dimensions are, of course, related in complex and varying ways. One of the key points of the lecture I wish to make is that understanding this relationship between the epistemic and the social authority of models requires a deeply sociological analysis. So let me start off saying a word or two about epistemic authority. The epistemic power of climate models comes from their being rooted in physical theory, from their using mathematical expressions of such theory to represent the physical dynamics of the oceans, atmosphere, and ice sheets. For example, the Navier-Stokes equations to describe the motions of fluid substances. Similar in principle, for example, to the numerical weather prediction models that our weather forecasts rely on. And yet climate models remain significant abstractions and simplifications of reality, physical reality. Wherever one looks, one finds exclusions, approximations, and parameterizations of observable physical processes. And yet the more physical processes that are simulated directly in a climate model, the greater the degrees of freedom of that model become. And the greater are the uncertainties, or at least the potential uncertainties, in model projections of the future. As one modeler has put it, models with too many degrees of freedom become nervous models. And here is a leading American modeling analyst, Kevin Tremberth, from a few months ago, in response to concerns about uncertainties in climate science, looking ahead to the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, suggesting that the spread in results, modelling results, is therefore bound to be large, and the uncertainty is much larger than for models in the last IPCC assessment. There are simply more things that can go wrong with these models. So these epistemic characteristics of climate models leave us with an unresolved tension. Do climate models provide answers to questions, or do climate models generate never-ending data from which more questions emerge? What exactly is the purpose of climate models? A tool for understanding climate processes? Naomi Oreskes, in her famous 94 paper on model verification, suggested that the primary value of climate models is heuristic. It's to challenge our thinking. Or is the purpose of climate models as a machine, as it were, to predict future climates? Many, of course, would suggest both. It's both heuristic and it's predictive. But it is the relationship between these different roles of climate models that requires us, I would suggest, to consider next, the social life of models. So a few remarks about the social authority that models exercise. So here the social authority, I suggest, of climate models resides in the interactions between scientific practices, these scientific modelling practices that give rise to models' epistemic authority, and the public visibility that these models gain in the social sphere. And here, as with Stephen Shapin and Simon Schaffer's idea of public witnessing of the knowledge offered by Boyle's air pump in the 17th century in their very well-known study from a few years ago, climate models need to be seen to be performing authentically and reliably. They need to be trusted. And to earn their social authority, climate models therefore need to inhabit public venues, and they need to display their epistemic claims of credible climate predictions. And these forms of public witnessing, if you will, might be done through a number of different ways. This sort of witnessing might be done through displays of the computational power. Many of the world's leading climate models are operated on some of the most powerful computers in the world. This form of public witnessing might be done through animated, colourful displays of simulated virtual climates. And also forms of public witnessing might be the endorsements, the public endorsements of climate models and their predictions from powerful or trusted actors. There's Clive Hamilton. And also in the context of public witnessing, one could argue that the IPCC has been a particularly important expert witness to the credibility of climate models. Those phrases, those judgments that I quoted early on from AR4, IPCC, rooted in climate modelling analysis and interpretation, the IPCC then is giving expert witness to the credibility of these models. So these forms of public witnessing, if indeed they are deemed trustworthy, endow climate models with social authority. But note, and again I shall return to this, that this social authority varies, sometimes quite radically, from society to society, or even within different parts of a society. Social authority can take on different forms and characteristics in different cultures and social settings. So with these opening considerations on the epistemic and the social authority of climate models, let me structure the following explorations in terms of the question, are climate models reliable? And as I shall explain, I do not mean reliable in simply the narrow sense of whether or not they offer an adequate representation of reality, but the broader question of the reliability of a climate model within a particular culture and for a particular purpose. And in this investigation, I'm using a framework, a structure, which I've elaborated somewhat from one that Arthur Peterson originally proposed. Peterson is a policy analyst, a climate modeler, philosopher. He sometimes calls himself, based at PBL in the Netherlands. So I'm indebted to Arthur to catalyzing my thinking in this area. And the framework I want to use is suggesting these four different levels of reliability within of a climate model, which Peterson called R1, R subscript 1, and R subscript 2. I've added two more to these. So coding precision, do climate models possess stable computer codes? Statistical accuracy, do model climates resemble observations? Methodological quality, are climate models well constructed? And what do we mean by that? And then social acceptability. Are climate models trustworthy? So briefly, I want to run through these. So first, reliability one, coding precision. Is the mathematical representation of the physical theory that's conceptualized in the model converted into stable computer code? We might think of this as the narrowest definition of model reliability, converting physical mathematical relationships in the conceptual model into computational algorithms, and hence executable computer code. In precision here, through the choice of numerical solutions and errors, coding errors, in often hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of lines of computer code, are almost inevitable in this process. But nevertheless, the question is that code stable? Is it portable? Is it movable? And reliability one, then, this stability of encoding within the model, is usually assessed internally by modeling teams or modeling centers. There may be occasions when this element of model reliability becomes contentious, and public demands may be made to open up the model. For example, one of the allegations associated with the released emails from UEA last December was the failure of the Climatic Research Unit to release computer code associated with their analysis of climate measurements. Now, these calls indeed related specifically to computer code governing the analysis of instrumental data, not the computer code of models, although some people actually thought they were. CREW doesn't do any primary climate modelling. And it would be perhaps almost impossible to subject the hundreds of thousands or millions of lines of computer code which comprises a global climate model to the same level of public scrutiny. Or at least I thought that until today, when I saw in the magazine Science a new project that has been launched by two British software engineers called the Climate Code Foundation. And they are very concerned because of the deterioration of public trust in elements of climate science in the last year or two, to bring the movement of open source software architecture into climate science. They've launched a website, they've got a video on YouTube, and what they are seeking to do over the next 3 years is to move the climate science community so that as a matter of course, the underlying code of all model-based analysis is placed in the public domain. Even to the extent, and here I did chuckle a bit, but maybe I shouldn't be chuckling, that their intention, their aspiration is in the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, every cited paper in that IPCC report is linked to a public website that displays the source code of the underlying model or models that that analysis is based on. So, actually, maybe this form of openness of underlying computer code in models may not be quite as far-fetched as perhaps I thought originally it would be. But this is what I mean by reliability one. Reliability two, statistical accuracy, or do model simulated climates bear a resemblance with observed climates? And it was this aspect of model reliability that first brought me into direct contact with climate models. Back in 1988, I arrived in the Climatic Research Unit, hired to work on a UK Department of Environment funded project, which was actually called Model of Validation. It's an interesting title. And it concerned the UK Met Office climate model at that time, and the desire of the Department of Environment to have an independent analysis team subject its simulated climate output to verification, or what actually was called in the contract, validation analysis. And that was back in 1988, and for the next 10 years, I did a lot of work on not just the Met Office model, but other climate models around the world, particularly with regard to their representation of precipitation outputs. Now, of course, there are well-known philosophical and practical problems associated with assessing this aspect of climate model reliability. I'm not going to rehearse these particularly this evening because they are generally very well known. But in summary, we can think of these in terms of philosophical problems. Naomi Oreskes, back in her 94 paper, very powerfully alluded to a number of these problems of model verification or model validation. And we'd have to say that verification of models is only possible in closed systems. Models of natural systems that are open and highly complex cannot be verified in a philosophical sense, as Oreske argued. We also have the problem of underdetermination when seeking to verify models. That is that different models may yield the same result, but for very different underlying conceptual or analytical reasons. So the problem of underdetermination is also a difficulty philosophically here with trying to verify models. At a practical level, we also have some well-rehearsed difficulties, starting with a very obvious one. Are the data, the observed data, the observed measurements against which the model simulated climate is being compared, are these these observed measurements actually independent of the model at all? And also, what happens when we have multiple observational data sets against which the model simulated climates are being compared? One of the earliest pieces of work I did on that, under that DOE contract, was to intercompare the number of different published observational data sets of rainfall around the world against which these models were going to be verified or validated. And of course, the uncertainties in these observations of rainfall were very, very substantial indeed. Second practical problem is that there are numerous indices, observed indices, against which a model might be verified. How do we judge which of these particular measures of performance are most important for a particular model or for a particular application? Are we concerned that it gets the global temperature reasonably well simulated, or are we concerned about how it performs in relation to the Asian monsoon? And there are many other dimensions, of course, as well. And then thirdly, practically, in these types of verification exercises, how much similarity between a simulated model climate and an observed climate is enough? What degree of similarity is necessary for one to judge that a model is adequate or verified? So these are well-rehearsed, well-known difficulties with this reliability too, this statistical accuracy by which models might be assessed. And of course, when it comes to long-term climate predictions emerging from climate models, we have an even greater difficulty in that it becomes virtually impossible to actually verify these predictions against observed reality, even in a qualified sense that I've just alluded to. Having said that, there are one or two cases that can be brought to this reliability two level. And here I'm refer to one piece of work that just recently published by Jules Hargreaves, looking back at one of the very first transient climate model simulations, the coupled ocean atmosphere model simulation that Jim Hansen's group at GISS published in 1988, the so-called greenhouse year. Hargreaves looked at Hansen's simulation, which is the blue trend line there, which over this 22-year period, Hansen's model predicted an increase of 0.26 degrees Celsius per decade. The black trend line in the graph are the observations since 1988, which has seen a rise of 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade. So the prediction was 0.26, the observations 0.18 degrees per decade. The null hypothesis that Hargreaves argued was based on persistence, and against that null hypothesis, the statistical analysis would say that Hansen's moral prediction undoubtedly had skill. It actually performed way better than a simple persistence forecast in representing what has happened over that 22-year period. But this type of verification of a climate model prediction is very rare, and it's very limited. This is simply looking at one index of a model performance, global temperature. And of course, according to Oreskes's analysis, the underlying climate model, in any case, is not being validated by this type of statistical exercise. So that's reliability two. If reliability two is focused more on the assessment of the model outputs, how well do those model outputs represent observed reality, then reliability three focuses more on the quality of what we might call the climate model inputs, namely issues like model structure, the boundary conditions that are used with the model, the design of the simulation experiments, the different levels of expertise that is enrolled in the construction and operation of the model, what sort of external collaborations does the modeling team have outside the modeling center, and so on. Arthur Peterson here describes this aspect of climate model reliability, that which derives from the methodological quality of the different elements in simulation practice, given the purpose of the model. Now, the variety of ways in which we might assess climate models in these terms of reliability three, we might assess the model design, the conceptual design. Is it simple? Is it elegant? Is it suitably complex or overly complex, given the purpose? We might consider the levels of expertise which have contributed to the model design. Should atmospheric scientists, for example, rather than marine biologists, design the ocean biogeochemistry module of a climate model? What sort of expertise is appropriate in designing the different components? And in fact, a few years ago, quite a long time ago now, the House of Lords Select Committee was somewhat critical of some of the early work that was being done on the UK Met Office model for this very issue about inappropriate levels of expertise. Or thirdly, we might ask, have the modelling team followed professional standards, if indeed such standards exist in that particular modelling enterprise? Underlying much of this reliability three assessment of climate models is the thorny question about whether or not different models do or should converge on the same prediction. Is prediction convergence across the population of climate models a sign of well-designed models and reliable predictions? Or is the convergence of predictions merely a sign of a high level of model interdependence? The same experts using the same algorithms calibrated against the same data. What does it mean when climate models agree? And the IPCC have adopted, certainly in the last two assessments, an approach which uses multi-model ensembles to quantify the range of uncertainty in climate model predictions, taking a suite, typically now around about 20 or 30, different model representations and predictions, and treating those as a population to look at the uncertainty ranges. But is such a democracy of models the right way to go, treating each model independently of each other and giving it an equal vote in the determination of the future? Climate models are rarely independent of each other. And actually, we don't know how to establish formally degrees of independence of climate models. Prediction convergence might simply imply that all the models are equally wrong. Climate modeller Rito Pannuti recently has warned against complacency here. There's a real danger of model convergence as a result of tuning, consensus on metrics and peer pressure, rather than improved understanding. The benefit of a more narrow projection range must be compared to the potential damage of overconfident projections and wrong decisions resulting from it. So we have some challenges with this third level of assessment of model reliability, reliability three. But let me move on to reliability four. Considerations of reliability three, the quality, the methodological quality of the models, is still largely contained to practices internal to the climate modelling community and their scientific networks. Although some degree of external public scrutiny might be exercised through certain regulatory practices or professional standards. But does coding precision in climate models, reliability one, combined with adequate statistical accuracy, reliability two, plus suitable methodological quality, reliability three, automatically generate trustworthy models? Is that all we actually have to worry about? I would say no. And so this fourth aspect of model reliability assessment requires careful scrutiny of how climate models exist as social objects in social worlds. And to scrutinize climate models according to this measure of reliability requires us to examine the networks that allow the model to exist, survive, and travel in society. These networks might be epistemic, and we've looked at some of that already. Which experts, for example, are enlisted in the design of the model? These networks might be financial. Who is paying for the climate model? And why is that investment being made? These networks might be discursive. What language and rhetoric is being used when outputs from climate models are being communicated? These networks might be political. Which political actors in which countries are offering their endorsement of these climate model predictions? Or these networks might be performative. How are model outputs displayed visually? Through animations, colours, virtual globes, and so on. So we may have epistemic, financial, discursive, political, or performative networks which establish this social authority of climate models in public spaces. To illustrate some of these aspects, let me draw upon the work of one of my PhD students, Martin Mahoney, and his examination of the Hadley Centre's PRACY model. PRACY is a regional climate model of high spatial and temporal resolution, spatial resolution about 25 kilometres, established over a particular regional domain of the Earth's surface. And over the last decade or so, this model has been distributed to over 100 countries worldwide. So there's a map showing the presence or the countries that have actually been using the PRACY model. PRACY, this regional model, carries the pedigree of the Hadley Centre's large Earth system modelling enterprise behind it. It also has gained certain national diplomatic weight as well from the British government through some of the funding processes. So what Martin has been able to show through his empirical work of this model and how this model travels around the world, this mobile model, if you like, is the many different functions that Precy has secured through its global passage. Functions that go well beyond Oreskes' notion of a model simply as a heuristic, I would suggest. So some of these would be, for example, Precy is very effective at raising awareness in different national and social settings. So, for example, the conclusion from his empirical work suggested that handing over a model to a foreign power is more effective than simply offering pre-prepared results from a model rooted in a host country. The Precy model also can make climate change real. It can localise the global, if you like the aphorism. And that localising of the global, of global climate change, is mediated through a model, a regional model. It also attracts, along its passage around the world, public endorsements. So, to quote one of the people involved in the development of the Precy model, it was also useful for us to have the UNDP, United Nations Development Programme, seal of approval on it, if you like. So it made it a bit more attractive, I think, that people knew that UNDP were on board. And then fourthly, the model facilitates political action. And again, to quote one of the users, regional users, in one of the smaller countries of the Precy model, to quote them, we were able to convince the international audience that even though they're talking about 2 degrees Celsius, that is the global political temperature target, two would be extremely detrimental to us. So outputs from models like Precy help us in terms of our convincing policymakers that they should take a stand. So here we see elements, dimensions of social authority being enlisted behind the Precy model as it moves around the world. At the same time as building the social authority, Precy would retain also its epistemic authority. So although the model is distributed to 100 countries, it is done so on certain conditions that tie the model back to the host institution or the host model, its UK parentage, if you will. The epistemic pedigree of the model is safeguarded through these chains of deferral. And its authority, epistemic authority, can also be displayed performatively by showing its realism, visual realism, in comparison with other lower resolution or cruder models. So, for example, this image might be shown, which would be a representation of a country in the global resolution model. Anyone guess what country that is? That's at a resolution of around about 400 kilometres. If you show it in the Precy model, at 25 kilometres, the country becomes... anyone? The Philippines. Okay. So this type of visual display underpins the claims that actually the Precy model is offering a higher degree of realism, certainly in the underlying topography here, that boosts the epistemic authority of the model. So in this little case study that I'm referring to then, Precy, as it moves around the world, the model gains social authority. It enters cultures, different cultures, through a process that Mahoney describes as epistemic colonization. The Precy model is a good example of Jasanov's co-production of scientific knowledge and social order at work simultaneously. Scientific knowledge and social order at work simultaneously, in this case mediated through a regional climate model. So to conclude, I asked at the beginning of this lecture, should we trust climate models and let them exercise authority over us? There is, of course, no simple answer to that question. Is there ever a simple answer? There's no doubt that climate models offer a powerful way, the single most powerful way, for scientists to organize their knowledge about the Earth system, to understand the physical interconnections between different parts of that system, and to help identify key sensitivities within that system. To understand a model implies at least some correlative understanding of physical reality. As someone again has quipped, climate modelling has become a behavioural science. Climate modelling is a study of the behaviour of the models. But the study of model behaviour should not be mistaken for the study of reality. Whether we, the public, citizens around the world, should therefore trust climate models when they are used to prognosticate about the far future, and hence whether we should defer our trillion-dollar decisions to the authority of models, whether we should do that requires a different set of questions to be asked. It's not just enough to be told by modellers about the stability of their code, reliability one, nor about the fidelity of their simulations, reliability two, nor even about the quality of the underlying model structures and design processes, reliability three. Even less is it enough to be told that all the models agree. As with all authoritative voices in society, with all powerful actors, it is important that climate models are subject to scrutiny and held accountable to broader sets of public norms and standards. Because these norms and standards are socially constructed, they will, of course, vary between cultures and between nations. It is insufficient to assert that climate models have universal and uniform authority simply on the basis of their epistemic power. Understanding the social authority of climate models, what I have termed reliability four, becomes critically important. Reliability four has to be evaluated case by case across different cultures, keeping in mind the different civic epistemologies of political cultures that Sheila Jasanoff has written about. And to give you a final example here, I want to show how two different science policy cultures, the UK and the Netherlands, have allowed climate models to exercise different degrees of authority over the future, different elements, if you like, of reliability four. So the first of these is from the UK, the latest set of UK climate projections supported by the government. And here, in the generation of these scenarios used increasingly widely around UK society, these scenarios were based on a modelling hierarchy from a modelling centre, the Hadley Centre, funded by largely by the British government. This modelling hierarchy offered sophisticated probabilities of changes in different weather parameters at potentially very fine temporal scales and a high degree of spatial resolution. The contrast, or a contrast, in a different policy, science policy culture setting would be the Netherlands. A few years ago, the Netherlands government published their national scenarios of the Netherlands. The Dutch Meteorological Institute was coordinating this work. And here, the scenario building exercise used a synthesis of different insights and methodologies. Yes, climate models were enlisted, not just one, but a range of different climate models. A variety of historical evidence was used to filter or to interpret that modelling data. And some degree of local meteorological synoptic meteorological reasoning from expert meteorologists then acted as a mediator between the model outputs and the final synthesized or blended scenarios. If you like, the climate models, the role of the climate models in an exercise was much more constrained than it was, for example, in the case of the UK CPO9 scenarios. So that example shows that very different statuses can be granted to climate models when creating descriptions of the future. And it should be evident, I'm not necessarily passing any normative judgment on those two examples, which is better or worse. I'm simply using them to point out that how models are utilized and what authority and role they're given in different political cultures will vary. So this is the purpose, then, that I want to use this example for, that reliability for can vary quite radically across different cultures and decision-making practices. Even if the underlying models might be adjudicated to possess similar degrees of reliability 1, 2, and 3. And a final remark back to the IPCC, where I also started off. And a note of caution here, I would suggest, for the way in which the IPCC conducts its work and establishes its claims based on climate models. Its authoritative deployment of climate models and their simulated knowledge of putative future climates becomes dangerous if, I would suggest, in doing so, it erases the differences that exist between cultures and societies in the different forms of social authority that are granted to climate models. So, we need to study climate models in society if we are to understand both the question that I posed in this lecture and also to understand any of the answers that we might come up with. If we really want to understand whether or not climate models have earned our trust, we have to go beyond the climate modelers, the climate analysts, and we have to have a deeper sociological analysis of their function. Thank you.